I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. This is a special episode of the Political Theory Review, as we are discussing two books, my guests and my own. I'm talking to Shiloh Brooks, instructor in the Herbst Program of Humanities at the University of Colorado, about his 2018 book, Nietzsche's Culture War, The Unity of the Untimely Meditations, from Palgrave Macmillan. We're also discussing my forthcoming book, Nietzsche's Unfashionable Observations, A Critical Introduction and Guide, with Edinburgh University Press. So Shiloh Brooks, thank you so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thanks for having me.
So Shiloh, today we're talking about Friedrich Nietzsche's second book, The Untimely Meditations, which we've both happened to write a whole book about. So isn't that great that we can get together and nerd out on this book? Happy to have you here. Maybe we could just start by talking, maybe you can say a little bit about the book as a whole. What is The Untimely Meditations for those of us who don't know this book? And how has it been read in the past?
Yeah, I mean, The Untimely Meditations is probably Nietzsche's most understudied book in a lot of ways. And some people read it as not being a book. It's often read or dismembered. It consists of four essays. And the second essay, The Use and Disadvantage of History for Life, is the one that's most frequently studied and commented on. And so most people sort of focus on that essay alone. And I think, and I think you think, that Nietzsche wrote these in a sequence. Of course, he had in mind up to 13 meditations. He only ever wrote four, but I think that the essays talk to one another. And it seems to me that a lot of what our books try to do is say, no, this is not just a bunch of sort of disparate essays that can be read willy-nilly. The book does form an argument. These four essays should be read in sequence, and they do speak to one another. And then we sort of try to say, what is Nietzsche trying to say in these four essays in a coherent, unified way?
Yeah, and I mean, just to reiterate that point, I mean, it is interesting how Nietzsche scholarship, you know, most Nietzsche scholars treat, say, Beyond Good and Evil or Thus Spoke Zarathustra, Genealogy, Morals, as a whole book, right? And in a way, Untimely Meditations is the exception to this, that scholars will, as you say, look at one essay, David Strauss, Use of Disadvantage of History for Life, Schopenhauer's Educator, Richard Wagner, Bayreuth, and just focus on that as if it's a standalone piece. I agree with you, though you have the first publication in my mind of a reading of The Untimely Meditations as a whole. So I'm just following in your footsteps, but we both have a view of the sort of overall structure and argument of the work. So maybe you can go first and just talk about maybe what the overall argument is, as you see it, the overall structure. And then we can get into some of the context issues and why this book's important.
Yeah, I mean, I think very broadly speaking, the argument of the book, it begins, you know, with this odd essay, David Strauss, The Confessor and the Writer. And this is really, in my view, I mean, Nietzsche says a lot of harsh things about people in his later writings. You know, he calls John Stuart Mill a flathead, and he calls a lot of people names. He really comes down on David Strauss. I mean, it's really, really intense, almost to the point of comedy and absurdity in some places. And but anyway, I think he's got a reason for doing that. And he, you know, David Strauss had written this book, The Life of Jesus Critically Examined, and then he had written a second book called The Old and New Faith, and the book had been a bestseller. And Nietzsche had read the book and was sort of appalled by some of its contents. It makes this argument that, you know, Christianity is falling by the wayside. Oddly, we see Nietzsche as kind of a defender of Christianity in a weird way in this essay, but it falling by the wayside, and the old faith is impoverished, no longer believable in the age of modern science. And so Strauss attempts to erect a kind of new ethical and cultural foundation on the basis of Darwinian science and other, and also a certain historical science. You know, he studied the Gospels and determined that they're fake, or they've been elaborate, you know, they've been embellished and these sorts of things. So Strauss says, we've got to found a new, in a way, a new way of life on the basis of modern science. And so Nietzsche sees, in my reading of the book, Strauss being elevated to a new position as kind of a cultural guiding light, spiritual guiding light in Germany. And Nietzsche makes the claim that Strauss is turning his readers into what he calls, what Nietzsche calls cultivated Philistines, very impoverished souls, spiritually impoverished, no profound appreciation of art or the big questions that have animated humanity, especially the ancient Greeks, questions about God. Questions about what the best way of life is, questions about community, freedom. And so Nietzsche is sort of appalled by the direction that the German mind, or the German spirit is going. And so he attacks Strauss and shows in the rest of the essay that Strauss is by no means a genius. And on page after page after page, he calls Strauss a man who wears the mask of genius. He calls him the Philistine chieftain. And in a way, that sets the tone for the rest of the book. And in the rest of the book, Nietzsche tries to show, first of all, what a true culture is, what a true culture needs. And then in the second half of the book, in the essays on Schopenhauer and Wagner, he shows readers what a true cultural genius would be. And so for my own interpretation, and this is the last thing I'll say, I went back to Ecce Homo, Nietzsche's great autobiography, and tried to see what he said about the untimely meditations. And one of the things he says is that he by no means intended to attack David Strauss, the man. He intended to diagnose a cultural illness. And then he says in the essays on Wagner and Schopenhauer, he meant to erect new spiritual ideals. And then he says, I didn't know it at the time, but those essays were about me. And so he says Schopenhauer and Wagner, or in one word, Nietzsche. And so he reveals in his great autobiography that he sees himself as the sort of great next great cultural genius, and therefore the solution to the problem of cultivated Philistinism in Germany. Although he didn't know this at the time, he has become that man. So,
yeah, that's good. That's a really good overview. I think in general, you emphasize the cultural elements here, and I think the Untimely Meditations is really a book about culture. So secondarily, I think about politics, and we can talk about the politics of it too, but it's really about culture and Nietzsche's discontent with modern culture and the possibilities for rejuvenation of modern culture. And I think that's sort of well established about the meditations and Nietzsche's early period work. I think sort of what's less appreciated, I think, is the other point that you emphasized, which is what's the point of culture? And Nietzsche is, I think, clearer in his early works than in his later works about culture is a new form of community, a new distinctively modern form of community whose purpose is to create exemplars, right? To create new forms of human excellence. And so that's his ultimate aim. And this is, again, another theme that's going to carry through into his late period works, this idea of exemplarity, human exemplarity, the loss of it in the modern age, and how to retrieve it. And so, yeah, I mean, just in general, the way I think we both read the structure of the Untimely Meditations is that it has a first negative half. So it has a deconstructive first two essays, David Strauss and Use and Disadvantage of History for Life, are in large part the negative project. The first essay critiquing the what I call the anti-genius, right? The anti-exemplar in the form of David Strauss, and the second essay deriding the modern culture. So then the second half of the book is going to be the positive reconstructive project. Schopenhauer's Educator marks a new beginning, and we'll talk about that, but that it lays the foundation for a new form of modern culture. And then the fourth essay, sort of mirroring then the first, is the attempt to create a new, foster the life of a new exemplar in the form of Richard Wagner, which of course Nietzsche changes his views pretty quickly about Richard Wagner. He's already kind of changing his views about Richard Wagner. We can talk about that later. But yeah, I mean, I think in general, that's the overall shape. Is there anything else you want to add on the sort of overall shape of things here?
No, that seems right to me. The critical half, the positive half, two and two. And that, I would just say, I guess the only other thing I would add is that there's a sense in which, you know, I've seen some people say, well, the Untimely Meditations is not a book. It's incomplete. Nietzsche intended to write 13 or 12 or whatever he says in his notebooks, but there's only four. And I think there's actually a pretty nice symmetry to the book. As we point out, there are two critical, too constructive or positive. And it seems to me that there's a sense, and I say this in my book, but there's a sense in which the project is complete. And I know it later in life, you thought, well, maybe I'll add another one and these sorts of things. But the project does consist of a whole thought, and it's very evenly balanced. And the last two essays do complete the thought that's begun especially in the first essay. And so for readers looking for a complete thought, or who are scared that, well, maybe this is going to be just sort of four essays and then he leaves me hanging. Not at all.
Yeah. And if you look at not to get too deep in the weeds here, but if you look at the publication history of the book, Nietzsche is always entitling each part as part of a whole, right? So he's intending these essays to be read as part of a whole project. And so you're right. I mean, he does construct different plans along the way, but it's pretty clear when you, I think, look at the details, what emerges is something that has a kind of elegant architecture that I think justifies our claim that it's a whole. Good. So maybe let's talk about the context for it. I thought what we could do is maybe you could talk a little bit about the historical and the political context of it, because I think you do a better job of that in your book. And I'll talk a little bit about the philosophical context of it.
Yeah, that seems right. I mean, I was going to say to you that your account of the intellectual context is much better, and you know a lot more about that than I do. But with the political context, I mean, I guess I was struck by the Entombing Meditations when I first read it. Really had no idea what the political context was. And then I started to look at some of the things Nietzsche was writing around the time, where he was, what was going on in Germany. And I found a few letters of his where he talks a bit about Bismarck. And then I noticed he was giving a lecture series at the time Bismarck was chancellor, and Bismarck was really revolutionizing the German educational institutions, taking power away from the Catholics and giving it to state administrators as overseers. And it occurred to me that at the exact time Nietzsche is giving these lectures on the German educational institutions, this massive education bill is passing through Bismarck and his Congress. And so I did some more research into this and sort of realized the fact that Nietzsche's really paying attention to politics at this time, especially the politics of education. And of course, he's a professor, a very young professor at the University of Basel. He's fought in the Franco-Prussian War, and he's seen Germany sort of consume the greatest, arguably the greatest cultural light in Europe at the time, and is curious what's going to happen in Germany now. What direction is Germany going to go under Bismarck? It seems like Germany's becoming a state, and by that I mean a place focused on politics, economy, war, and less of a kind of culturally rich, you know, land of Goethe and Beethoven and Bach and these sorts of things, that those sorts of things have fallen by the wayside. And so Nietzsche seems to me to be writing the Entombing Meditations as a response, a direct response to the empowerment and massive explosion and growth of the German state under Bismarck. Directly addresses him several times. And I think you point this out in your book, and I point it out in mine too. The David Strauss, the Confessor and the Writer, doesn't really open with a critique of David Strauss. It opens with a critique of the German state. And so that's sort of the historical context, is that Germany is on the rise, Bismarck is in power, and Germany is becoming sort of the Germany that the world will soon know, you know, over the course of the next 100 years, for all of its glories and all of its ills and utterly catastrophic and horrible things. So that's the historical context. And it seems to me that Nietzsche is intensely concerned with the cultivation of the German person by means of these educational institutions. What are people going to become if Bismarck gets his way? And so Nietzsche is, in a certain sense, it seems to me, pushing back against the modern bureaucracy, the bureaucratic transformation of educational institutions, the secularization of educational institutions. He's pushing back against the modernization of educational institutions. He's a proponent of the classical Greek, sort of a liberal arts method of education. So this is the political context at the time, and Nietzsche's intensely interested. He even says in a letter he's thinking about writing Bismarck to you know, say some things about his views on education.
Right. It's too bad he never did, right? He never did write
that. Yeah, I can't find it.
Yeah, that's, I mean, and that's very helpful to keep in mind, I think, for, I've had a couple people on the show and we've talked about Nietzsche's politics, and this is extremely important, I think, context to keep in mind, because Nietzsche develops his political theory precisely in reaction to the rise of the sort of secular state, and is deeply critical and skeptical of state power. And so that's going to be important, I think, when we talk about a little bit later about what this means for the actual substance of his argument. So let me say a little bit about the philosophical context. As the way I read the Untimely Meditations, and in part this is also the context for The Birth of Tragedy, although I think Nietzsche comes more into his own in the Untimely Meditations than in the Birth of Tragedy, but Nietzsche is reacting in large part to the great neo-Kantian revival that's going on in the mid part of the 19th century. So after the decline, really, of the great Hegel in the mid part of the century, the rise of modern science in Germany, really philosophers started to be skeptical of these big metaphysical systems and started to turn towards a materialist approach that you see especially in the young Hegelians, though, in others like Buchner. And then there's a kind of counter reaction against the development of materialism, that materialism maybe does not capture what's distinctively human in contrast to what's merely matter and what's animal. And so philosophers turn back, of course. This is something that Germans do, is turn back to Kant. Their great hero. And so to turn back to Kant, and especially Kant's metaphysical humility, something that's often emphasized. And so there's an effort in the mid part of the century to combine Kant with the great developments in modern science, the great, Darwin is just on the horizon. And so Kant becomes an important figure, not just, I think, for the epistemological projects, but also for the ethical projects. You can see this in two of Nietzsche's heroes, in Friedrich Albert Lange and in Schopenhauer, of course. Schopenhauer is somewhat of an outlier, because he, although influenced by Kant, develops what becomes a really animating ethical conundrum for philosophers extending throughout the 19th century, which is the conflict over pessimism, his doctrine of pessimism, or the pessimismus streit, as it's called. And so that, in a nutshell, is the worry that Schopenhauer introduces, that life simply has no value. And it's better to die soon, or it's better not to live at all, but better to die soon, as Nietzsche puts it in the Birth of Tragedy, in the mouth of Silenus. And so Nietzsche follows Schopenhauer in large part in this problem, in trying to address the valuelessness of human existence. And what I argue is that Nietzsche adopts a Kantian solution to this problem, if not going all the way down the road of Kant. And this, I think, is one of the more controversial elements of my reading. People have criticized me. Isn't Nietzsche a critic of Kant? Yes, he is a critic of Kant, but his project is deeply suffused by a debt to him, particularly with the importance of the value of human freedom. The idea of autonomy that Kant introduces, that what's distinctively human is our capacity to liberate ourselves from our animal instincts and give ourselves a law of our own making. And this is something that unifies then the Untimely Meditations in their goal, I think, which is the idea to develop foster a human being who can give himself, and I say himself because it's often a man for Nietzsche, give himself a law, give himself a full personality that's self-determining from top to bottom. This is not, Nietzsche, of course, departs from the rationalism and abstractness of Kantian moral law, but it's an important feature to keep in mind, that this is still a project in the Kantian tradition of autonomy, which, of course, distinguishes him sharply from Schopenhauer. but it's important to keep in mind, because when thinking about this is something that scholars have been wrestling with for some time, which is the normative basis of Nietzsche's project. We're going to be talking about Nietzsche's exemplars and an excellent life. And often this is something that I've often been dissatisfied before I kind of came up with this reading is, well, why should we believe Nietzsche? I mean, maybe he just has a kind of fetishism for for these forms of excellence. Why is it that we should believe him? So if you think of it as sort of developing this in this post-Kantian tradition of autonomy, that autonomy is the thing that sits at the bottom of Nietzsche's project. That's I think more helpful in getting a groundwork for it. And I think more satisfying in a way than the kind of naturalistic readings. That's the other alternative that many Nietzsche scholars look towards for a kind of foundation for Nietzsche's positive ethics, which is that nature grounds the ethical claims, which I find to be unsatisfying for several. This goes a little bit beyond the book, but Nietzsche is throughout his career very critical of any appeal to nature, because nature is indifferent to human existence. It doesn't give us guidance. We have to liberate ourselves from nature. We have to overcome. And so I find in the idea of freedom as the sort of key guiding light. How did that sound? Was it convincing? I'm not sure whether I'm shouting into the void with the
Kantian. Yeah, reading. I mean, it certainly seems compelling, compelling to me. And you know, this book, I like what you say about nature, and I'm confronted with the same problem that you're confronted with when it comes to Nietzsche and nature as a standard. And I know much less about Kant than you do, and hadn't really put together the Kantian autonomy as a kind of a solution to the problem. And I find that that's a compelling and interesting solution to me. There's certain people who are going to say there's a sort of aesthetic standard that's completely divorced from nature that can be developed. And, you know, essentially what I find valuable about your account is that you are clearly wrestling with the problem that Nietzsche, the problem of nature in Nietzsche. And there has to, I mean, if we're going to take Nietzsche seriously, there's got to be some sort of solution to it, or at least a coherent account of his awareness of the problem and how he thought he had found his way out of it. And what your book seems to me to do is present a solution that, it, as you say, not many Nietzsche scholars are proposing, and it does so in a compelling and sort of fresh way.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Yeah, thanks. A couple things you said with sort of triggered a few thoughts. I mean, one is that, so I'm not alone in thinking that, you know, there's a kind of Kantian, there are a number of scholars like R. Kevin Hill, who's written this book called Nietzsche's Critiques, where he sort of tracks more in a textual way than I do that when Nietzsche's reading Kant, and Nietzsche, so is clearly much more indebted to Kant than we I think Nietzsche scholars had realized before. So that I think is really helpful. Nietzsche, it's not clear how much actually primary engagement he had with Kant, that is how many of Kant's texts he worked with, but Kant is in the air in a deep and profound way, in the way I described a few minutes ago, in this big neo-Kantian revival. So Nietzsche would have been swept up in it just simply in virtue of being part of the philosophical landscape. And it's, I think sometimes, and you mentioned the sort of aesthetic reading of Nietzsche, which is, you know, often associated with the postmodern reading of Nietzsche, which I at least am happy that reading has gone a little bit by the wayside, in part because it treats Nietzsche as sort of able to elevate himself beyond his context, right? That he's a kind of postmodernist, that he's able to move beyond it. But Nietzsche was reacting to the philosophical claims of his time. This doesn't mean he wasn't radical thinker, he was, but one I think needs to place him into that context. And I think reading his aesthetic, you know, Nietzsche throughout the Untime of Meditations talks a lot about art and the aesthetic. And in a deeply Kantian way, he of course uses this term exemplar, exemplar in German, which is directly from Kant's Third Critique, where he talks about near the end of the first part on the aesthetic judgment, where he talks about genius and how to make sense of genius. And Kant says, okay, so how do we make sense of it? How do we distinguish between genius and non-genius? Because of course there isn't a standard that we can point towards to say, hey, you know, Mozart is doing something great. Because if you can develop a standard for making sense of Mozart, then in some sense, Mozart isn't so radical after all. You've already sort of paved the way for Mozart, but Mozart in a way invents a new world. And so the way that Kant distinguishes between genius and non-genius, or what he calls original nonsense, is to talk about how what he calls the exemplar sets an example for others that can be taken up, mm-hmm. right? So that Mozart, say, or Beethoven, sets an example for others, that they themselves create their own world, which then suffuses their life and their art, and then gives rise to a new type of world mm-hmm. outside of in the broader community. And so that you know, that's the way that Kant develops that idea of exemplarity, but specifically within the aesthetics. And I think Nietzsche just broadly expands it to a project of human excellence in general.
Yeah.
Good. Well, so unless you have anything else, maybe I thought we could start talking about the individual essays.
Sure.
How's that sound?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about David Strauss. You started talking about him near the David Strauss essay in your opening remarks, especially that important first section in which Nietzsche challenges the self-aggrandizement of the German people in the wake of the German unification in 1871 and the victory over the French. Mm-hmm. So you could say a little bit more about maybe the overall argument of Strauss and why the essay is important.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mentioned Strauss had written this book, The Old and New Faith, and the David Strauss, the Confessor and the Writer, is a sort of, I guess you could read it, I sometimes say it this way, is the most critical book review ever written by any human being ever. And Nietzsche reads the book. You would never want Nietzsche to review your book, but Nietzsche reads this book, The Old and New Faith by Strauss, which consists of four chapters. Most of the chapters have to do with what are we going to do in the wake of the decay of Christianity. We can no longer take Christianity seriously in the wake of modern science, and it's especially Darwinism. And so what are we going to do about life? What is there a new faith that can replace the old? And for Strauss, the new faith is a kind of faith in modern science and its capacities to guide human affairs and enrich human life. And so Nietzsche sees this, and we'll get into this a little bit more in the second essay, but Nietzsche sees this as, in a way, he's appalled by this. And, you know, the reasons are many. It's not clear to me, you and me may read the second essay differently on this particular point, but Nietzsche has a certain kind of, at least it seems to me in David Strauss and in The Use and Disadvantage of History, a certain skepticism about the capacities of science to really and truly enrich human life. And so there's a sense in which he attacks just the bald and limitless pursuit of knowledge for its own sake. And David Strauss seems to me, insofar as David Strauss is an endorser of modern science, Nietzsche seems to me to attack him on these grounds, that this thing that Strauss says is going to provide some fulfillment, namely science, scientific knowledge, is actually going to impoverish the human soul. Nietzsche makes the claim, you can already see that in the new species on the rise in Germany, the new species of human being called the cultivated Philistine. And these people, Nietzsche says, they're people who are, in a conventional sense, or in quotation marks, educated people. They read the newspapers, and they're broadly aware, you know, of sort of encyclopedia articles, and they go to concerts, and they sort of discuss music and things at the beer hall, and they may go to zoos and learn a little bit about natural science. And Nietzsche has this sort of contempt for them, it seems to me, as sort of casual minds who walk through life convinced that life's greatest questions have been answered. Science can relieve the human estate. You can know what you want to know. You can dabble in this, dabble in that, sort of dilettantishly. And Nietzsche has a kind of he's just come off writing The Birth of Tragedy and sort of has explored this Greek confrontation with the deepest and darkest components of human life and human psychology, and now to be confronted with a human type who's just sort of a casual, easygoing, secular dilettante, he's somewhat appalled by this. And I think he thinks that this does not bode well for the enrichment of the German people or for the future of German culture, which has such a rich history of philosophy, poetry, and music, that this could really spell their doom. And I think he's not just concerned, and this is an important point, I think he's not just concerned with the Germans. I think the Untimely Meditations can be read as a German book, but in David Strauss, the Confessor and the Writer, he says that the Germans are a symbol of, or the prototype of, modern humanity, that this is modern man. This is the fate of modern times, the sort of project of modernity, the scientific project of modernity. So he really turns on it in David Strauss, the Confessor and the Writer, attacks David Strauss and says, if you want a cultural paragon like Goethe or Beethoven, this is not your man. In fact, he's a joke. And Nietzsche does some things that, you know, any respectable person you would think wouldn't do. Strauss is much older than Nietzsche. He's much more established. He's well known. He's famous. Nietzsche is a nobody at the time he writes David Strauss. And so for him to say some of these things, it's deeply disrespectful of his elders. As an academic, it's risky, although Strauss himself was sort of outed, kicked out of the academic world. But Nietzsche says, you know, this guy can't, at the end of the essay, the most appalling thing, this guy can't even write. And so Nietzsche goes through, he doesn't just say, oh, his ideas are bad. He says, look at how bad his writing is. Look at what a stupid phrase this is. Look at how he uses these words, these dumb similes, you know, and he just really tears this guy down. And I think you can read it, and a lot of scholars, the very few who have paid attention to it, have just said, well, this is just an intoxicating, you know, anger trip inspired by Wagner, who hated David Strauss because they had a public spat. But I think, you know, if you, I looked at some aphorisms in Human, All Too Human, and other places where Nietzsche says, no, in fact, and this is Schopenhauer says these things too, that the quality of a man or woman's writing is evidence of the quality of the mind. And Nietzsche wants to say, look, our German language is a rich language. We've had Goethe. We've had, you know, these beautiful poet. We have myself, Friedrich Nietzsche. This man can't even write. And so to say that he can found a new culture on the basis of a new faith in modern science, who knows what kinds of horrible things this could lead to. So that in broad view is David Strauss.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And one of the other, I think, related interesting things about David Strauss, the critique there is, at least the way that it strikes me, is that his criticism of modernity in the second essay, in The Use and Abuse, is largely about the problem of knowledge and the endless accumulation of knowledge. One of the interesting things about the first essay in David Strauss is the way in which what he's taking issue with, say that, you know, we could say like the superficiality of the chattering classes, which is a phenomenon that has not gone away, right? And Nietzsche would be around today. So this is, yeah, not, we haven't left it behind. Sure. In any case, is the way in which that superficiality, the bad writing, et cetera, is all connected with the problem of the democratizing of the modern age. And so this is something, I mean, sometimes scholars carve up, you know, Nietzsche's critique of modernity, the early period, is about the problem of knowledge and the accumulation of knowledge. And only in the later period do you get the awareness of the problems of democracy, but it's already there in the first essay, The Untimely Meditations. It was already there in the lectures on education, that the democratization of the modern age leaves with it a sort of decline or loss of standards of excellence, right? That the problem with the chattering classes is not that they appreciate art and culture. That's great. But the problem is that they don't distinguish between the excellence of a Goethe and the excellence of some no-name poet, right? That they're not able to find a way to rank order human excellence, right? Human effort. And so that's I think at the heart of the issue here. Do you want to say anything else about the Strauss essay?
I don't think so. I mean, we can talk more maybe in a moment about the way it transitions. The reason the Strauss essay comes before the Use and Abuse, Use and Disadvantage of History.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and say that? Yeah,
I mean, for me, the one striking thing about David Strauss, the confessor and the writer, is that Strauss had written this book called The Life of Jesus Critically Examined. And that book got him in a lot of trouble. And it got him in a lot of trouble, not only with Christians, but even with the young Hegelian groups of which he was a part. And in The Life of Jesus, it's a huge book. It's, you know, 1,000 pages or something like this. And what Strauss essentially does is he goes through the Gospels and he critically examines them, as the title says, and he looks at sort of the deeds of Jesus, the miracles of Jesus, Jesus's life, and says, well, this was actually embellished. And this can actually all be explained, not on the basis of the supernatural, but you can see here that this is poetically embellished, or that, you know, modern science can give an account of how this thing that looked like a miracle is actually not miraculous. And so Strauss uses, he conducts a certain kind of scientific history insofar as he goes through something, the Gospels, which I don't think Nietzsche was a believer at the time. Nietzsche might've said, or a kind of life-promoting illusion for people, although Christianity doesn't necessarily promote life, but nonetheless, it was a myth, Nietzsche's view, that was fulfilling, that filled the soul in a much more profound way than modern science does. Strauss goes through that and really breaks it apart and says all of these things can be explained on the basis of this worldly causes. And so you get this Nietzsche critiquing this man, and he mentions this also in The Old and New Faith. It's not just in the Life of Jesus. So you get the second untimely meditation, which is a criticism of scientific history in the way that it makes impossible a certain kind of cultural and spiritual fulfillment, that it destroys, you know, illusions and these sorts of things. The man who Nietzsche had attacked in the previous essay was the poster child of doing precisely that for the greatest religion in the West. And so it's a pretty interesting shift to me from David Strauss, the Confessor and the Writer, to The Use and Disadvantage of History, because Nietzsche attacks scientific history of the, I mean, and there are many different breeds of scientific history, but he attacks a certain strain of it, of which Strauss is guilty of having implemented or employed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. And you speaking just now reminded me of what I was going to say, which was about David Strauss and science. So it's relevant here, which I think the way you put it earlier was about the value that Nietzsche sees in science. So it serves as a good transition, which is something like this. I think one of the things that, at least in the first essay where science makes its appearance, is in the following way, that Strauss pretends to be a sort of champion of science, that he's following recent scientific discoveries in modern science. And so this is an example of how neo-Kantian is trying to synthesize his work with the discoveries of modern science. But what's useful for Nietzsche about modern science is precisely the ways in which the discoveries of modern science challenge Strauss's worldview. Nietzsche talks about how, say the Darwinian worldview reveals the utter indifference and wastefulness of the natural mm-hmm. world, that it's not organized rationally in the way that Strauss expects. Strauss in The Old and New Faith gives a kind of idealized history of the world in which humanity is the sort of full flowering, the self-realization of a sort of natural tendency. And so there's a kind of rationality to the world that Nietzsche thinks that modern science has sort of discovered, that it's more or less random, that human beings are a kind of random eruption from a natural processes. And so science is actually useful in Nietzsche's view in exploding right. myths in that way. That's going to be important for me, for my reading in the second essay, but science, it's for Nietzsche, it's hard to go back to that yeah. mythical age, because science has really exploded those, the groundwork for those kinds of claims.
I agree. What you say reminds me, just to say this by way of clarification, that I don't mean to suggest that Nietzsche is a critic of science wholesale. I mean, you're not implying that, but I should make that clear, that you absolutely, what you say about Nietzsche's interest in Darwin is right. He attacks Strauss not so much for being scientific simply, which is what my previous remarks may have suggested. It's that what you say, it's that Strauss doesn't come to terms with the very painful implications of what modern science could mean for human life and human existence. And so, you know, Nietzsche, himself confronts these manfully and nobly, the way the Greeks confronted the problem of human existence manfully and nobly with Greek tragedy. Nietzsche says of Strauss and the Philistines, look, they claim to worship science. They claim that it's a guide, but they're not even confronting the potentially dark and utterly terrifying implications of Darwin and other things, you know, cosmology and these sorts of things for human existence. And so Nietzsche is himself trying to come to terms with that in The Untimelies. And we may say, well, you may say he comes to terms with it this way. And I say, well, no, he comes to terms with it that way. But you're right that this is the fundamental problem. And I agree with
yeah,
you.
Yeah. And it's in, of course, famously in the ninth section, is it? Of Untimely, or of The Use and Disadvantage yeah. of History for Life, where he talks about the deadly truths that
right.
modern science has discovered, that there's no cardinal difference between human beings and animals, that there's a sort of universal becoming that suffuses the world. So these are discoveries of modern science that fundamentally mark a distinction in his mind from the pre-modern age, the age of myth, and the modern age, the age of science. And there's really no going back. For this is, I think, what makes Nietzsche a modernist ultimately, that he wants to work on the foundation of modernism to build something new and not return to a mythic age. But so maybe we would talk about Use and Disadvantage of History for Life, because this is, as you said before, the most famous essay in this work, and it's been I think really sort of misread fundamentally in a way I could say, talk about it in a second, but maybe you just want to give a brief overview of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting essay for this reason, that Nietzsche, as you say, it's the most studied by modern scholars, although it's the one that I think Nietzsche probably remarks on the least. Certainly in his letters and in Ecce Homo, he just sort of passes by it and spends a lot more time on the others. But the essay is the only one with a foreword, which both of us have noticed. And the foreword sort of, I think, in my view, prepares the reader for the utterly disorienting and, in a way, unexpected criticism that's about to come. It's not an essay that one can just approach and read. One needs to be prepared, because he really is trying to upend, in a way, historical science, modern education more broadly, scholarship, things which we sort of take for granted in the academy today, Nietzsche really attacks. And so the essay takes the form of a sweeping critique of what Nietzsche calls the science of history. And also sort of thrown in there is Hegelian history or Hegelian historicism as well. Oftentimes, the problem that I found when reading the essay is that he doesn't really give an account of who scientific historians are. Occasionally, he drops a name. He doesn't say exactly what he thinks scientific history is, but he gives some account of what he thinks some of its methods are. It indiscriminately pursues historical knowledge just for the sake of accumulating more and more and more in a sort of scientific manner. It's very concerned with the facts on the ground with respect to history, what really happened. And you can look at history in any modern history department in the massive footnote apparatus and this sort of thing that goes along with scholarly history and get an account of sort of what Nietzsche had in mind, at least an introductory account to what Nietzsche had in mind with scientific history. There's also a great critique of Hegelian history and some of the things. And Nietzsche's claim with respect to both of these criticisms is that imbibing these two forms of history, the scientific and the Hegelian, they exhaust the human soul. The scientific history exhausts the human soul because it fills the human soul with a disorienting number of facts, which the human being can't make use of. And so the human being is overwhelmed by the greatness of the past, all the things that happened in the past, and is therefore in a way paralyzed by the knowledge. And in other words, we become fully theoretical beings of filled with knowledge, and we no longer have any capacity to act because we're paralyzed by the great actions of the past. We have knowledge of the great actions of the past. And Hegelian historicism is paralyzing because it says, well, the present is the end of history. It's over. The modern liberal state is sort of the culmination of a great long historical tale. And so for Nietzsche, it seems there's just no more reason to have ambition. There's not much left to do but be a cultivated Philistine. And in the 10th section of The Use and Disadvantage of History, Nietzsche says that contemporary historical education produces the aesthetically cultivated Philistine. He uses the term again from David Strauss. And of course, David Strauss was both a scientific historian and at one point in his life, a young Hegelian. And so Nietzsche, by my reading, offers in the beginning of the essay three new possible approaches to the study of history, all three of which are meant to infuse the soul, inspire the soul, instead of exhausting it paralyzing it. And these three types are the monumental history, antiquarian history, and critical history. And Nietzsche says that these three types of history are useful to cultures in different circumstances. It depends a lot on, you know, where that culture or nation is in its life cycle. And they're also useful to individuals. It depends, of course, on the circumstances. Monumental history could be harmful to a certain nation or culture at a given time. Antiquarian could be harmful. And Nietzsche had envisioned the philosopher as a cultural physician in earlier notebook writings, and even intended to write a book called The Philosopher's Cultural Physician. And in this part of the essay, he seems to be playing the part of the cultural physician by saying, you know, ill cultures, cultures with this problem, I prescribe this kind of history, cultures with that problem, I prescribe this other kind of history. And so that's the basic form of the book, is in what ways does history harm us, the disadvantage uses, and in what ways does history benefit us? And all of this has in its background, again, a kind of critique or confrontation with modern science and modern science's implications, historical science and natural science for man.
So I want to look a little bit more at the three different types of history, because these are extremely famous types of history, and scholars have noticed that they in some way disappear. So I wanted to talk, maybe we could talk about the lasting significance of it. But one of the things in my view, at least, that to say right off the bat, to sort of complicate the good story that you've told already, is I think the book is usually read in terms of, you know, here are the advantages of the history for life, these three monumental, antiquarian, and critical. Those are the advantages of history for life. And then the disadvantages all come in modern scientific views of history. One of the things I think to notice about the book is that's certainly the emphasis, although Nietzsche also sees disadvantages with monumental, antiquarian, and critical history. And I think this is the thing that's really not noticed, is that he sees advantages in the modern scientific view of history. They're kind of hard to spot, but he does. So maybe we would say a little bit more about the monumental, antiquarian, and critical views of history. You want to say just briefly about what they are and how they're related?
Sure. I mean, and this, I think this probably part of the untimelies is where our interpretations diverge. And so that'll be interesting for people too. Just broadly speaking, the monumental history is is sort of history of great men. And I know you associate Nietzsche's three types of history with ancient history. Right. And occasionally Nietzsche gives the ancient example, people like Plutarch, but essentially, or Polybius. But essentially monumental history would be a kind of history of great individuals or great events, not really concerned with the details, not really like scientific history going in and saying, well, you know, sure, so-and-so was great, but they were also an alcoholic and a womanizer or something like that. You know,
or that other people contributed, right? It's a sort of great man view of history.
That's right.
Right. Which Nietzsche recognizes this is a problem, right? I mean, that's the interesting bit about this.
And he says that monumental history is fitting above all for cultures in which there's no great human beings around to inspire anyone, or there's someone who hasn't, maybe a young person in particular, the untimelies are addressed to the young, a person around who has grand ambition, but no models in their own time. You can go and nourish your soul by reading accounts of the great souls of the past. And so monumental history is useful above all for people who have ambition to be active people. And in a way, great people who want to have monuments made of them, the way George Washington or Abraham Lincoln has monuments made. And so it's useful in that sense. Now, it can maybe this is a problem with it, maybe it isn't, but occasionally monumental history is simply fictional. It's not historical at all. It goes to such lengths to aggrandize these people that it verges on the fictional. Now, I think, in my view, for Nietzsche, that's not such a bad thing. He's guilty of the same thing in the Schopenhauer and Wagner essays. Those are not accurate portraits of those men at all, mm-hmm. and I think he knew it. And neither is his own Portrait Ecce Homo. That is entirely fictional.
Just to jump in on this particular point, I don't think it's a problem. I mean, I don't think it's bad either on Nietzsche's view. He does say it's a disadvantage of history. What exactly does he mean? I think just to sort of flesh out my own reading that these are pre-modern forms of history, that it's a problem in the sense that it's extremely difficult after the development of modern science to have a simply monumental history anymore, right? To have the reverence for George Washington or an Abraham Lincoln, to have the types of history that will whitewash them, right? We're facing this problem now with statues coming down, people being stripped of their names in universities, right? For Nietzsche, it's difficult, I think, to return to a simply monumental history.
Yeah.
I think it's also, he's going to point towards is to synthesize or appropriate monumental history in a modern context. Mm-hmm. So I think in this sense, I don't know if we disagree all that much. It might be more pedantic than anything else, right. but he's certainly going to try to, he's laying out these forms of history as pre-modern forms, but as forms that possibly can return in a certain way, and as long as they're incorporated in the right way in the modern culture.
Yeah. Yeah. That seems right to me. And of course I've had to confront, just as you have, the problem. I praise monumental history a lot more, I think, than you do. And I would, the modern problem of, well, what do we do in the age of science? And I point to people, at least in some lectures I've given, people like Winston Churchill, Theodore Roosevelt, mm-hmm. who did write histories mm-hmm. of great human beings, who were in a way monumental historians. I don't want to single anyone out. Gordon Wood has some nice, account. He has this book, Revolutionary Characters, on the founders, that seems to restore some of the dignity. It doesn't shirk away from some of the bad things, but it seems to me you're right. This is a problem. And I think in a way, monumental history does have to be modernized. The only thing I would say is that the thirst for it still remains. In other words, if you tell students great human beings are out there and you can be one, they want to be one. They thirst for an account of a person like Lincoln. And so the need is still there. Mm-hmm. We just have to fulfill the modern form. But of course, the downside of monumental history, Nietzsche says, is that what you get a lot of times are people writing histories of great people, or if not introducing young people to great thinkers, great statesmen, and these sorts of people. And they do it, and then they say, and you could never be that way. Look how amazing Napoleon was. Look how brilliant Lincoln was. And so they use monumental history not to inflate and inspire hope, but to deflate. And one sees this also in the academy on occasion, that the books are no longer there to nourish the soul. They're there in a certain sense to, in a way, you take revenge on these people who we're better than, or and who we could never live up to. So that is monumental history. Antiquarian history, Nietzsche says, is useful to cultures whose greatness has really passed them by. They're sort of on the decline. And so they become antiquarians insofar as they preserve all of the great things about their past, maybe a sort of declining Rome or a declining Sparta or Athens or someone like that. And they make, they have festivals and statues, but all the things that they really celebrate, really they're not that great anymore. They've lost a lot of their territory. There's been something awful has happened. And so they become preservers in order to have something on which they can sort of raise future generations as they see it's worthwhile being here, and this town is beautiful, and this is where this happened. And so there's this claim that this culture, this kind of culture that whose greatness has passed it by, needs antiquarian preservation. Now, the problem with antiquarian history is that it can be overused and misused, and much of my argument hinges on this. And Nietzsche says that, well, when antiquarian history is misused, you get a culture that's in decline that really needs to die, that's sort of preserving itself the way a dying animal or an old person or someone like that does, and is actually sort of miserable. And so he'll say things like, you get an obsession with preservation to the point that the preservation is no longer even geared toward the great deeds of the past, but they want to preserve everything. It's like they're canners. All the vegetables have to be canned and everything has to be preserved. It's like you're a grandmother. Every piece of string is valuable. And so he says, you know, what ends up happening is that they mummify the entire past with no discrimination for what ought to be preserved, what's worthy of being preserved. And then he says, you know, they even become hungry for the dust of bibliographic minutiae. And at the peak of the abuse of antiquarian history, the scholar is venerated and scholarship and that sort of scholarly history rises. I don't know if you, do you want to say anything else about antiquarian history?
Yeah. No, that was good. I mean, just to emphasize maybe the positive component of antiquarian history when it's in its proper, so to say, pre-modern form. There's a communitarian element to it, right? That one of the things that antiquarian history does is that it connects you to what he says, you know, is that the city, the individuals and the around you, the items of your history. So there's a way in which it, you know, monumental history is about the free self-determination, the founding efforts of individuals. Antiquarian history is about the community and how the community sustains itself over time. I mean, I see the connection between monumental and antiquarian in that way, that the individual provides the sort of founding efforts and the antiquarian sustains them. Now, you're right. Nietzsche is certainly very concerned about the abuse of antiquarian history. I think you're absolutely right that it has this connection, deep connection with modern science. But the difference between modern science and antiquarian history is that antiquarian history has that communitarian element, whereas modern science destroys that, right? It's universal. It's cosmopolitan. There's no home really for modern scholars. They're totally homeless. They go from ancient Greece to modern Germany in a matter of moments. So there is a benefit to antiquarian history. It's just been that connection, I think, with the community has been lost.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah. So let's talk critical history. Yeah, Go ahead.
Critical history is sort of the one that doesn't really have a positive side. I mean, it does, but it's a destroyer. These others, like monumental and antiquarian, have a kind of inspirational component to them, a salutary component. Critical history is always always has a destructive effect on a culture. And so Nietzsche says, you know, occasionally, and what I suppose what's revealed in critical history is the fact that what we're actually talking about here is a cycle. And so Nietzsche says, when a culture has grown old and sort of exhausted, it needs to be torn apart. It needs to be exposed for being impoverished. And so critical history is exactly what its name suggests. A critic comes along, points his finger or her finger at a culture and says, here are all the reasons why this is no longer worthwhile, never was worthwhile. And so in a sense, critical history does grave injustice to a culture. It just sort of indiscriminately and destructively tears apart. But its positive effect, after, you know, a culture is torn apart, the ground is leveled and the way is paved for what Nietzsche calls the creation of a new nature, a second human nature, which can arise on the ashes of the first. And so what critical history seems to reveal is something like this, that at least in my reading, monumental history stands at the beginning of a cycle in which great deeds are performed, great human beings, the nation is on a kind of ascent. As in every nation, there's a kind of stasis and then a sort of decline. During that period of stasis or decline, antiquarian history is needed to preserve and to continue to cultivate. But once the culture or nation is exhausted, and I think Nietzsche thinks every culture or nation has a kind of life cycle. There's no regime in human history that's been perpetual. We don't know of any. That it has to be torn up and the way has to be paved for something new. And so in a way, history itself has the cycle of life, monumental greatness, antiquarian, stasis and decline, and then critical tearing apart and paving the way for new monumental men, which Nietzsche calls for on occasion in The Use and Disadvantage of History, to emerge, take the reins of a culture and take it higher and begin the cycle all over again.
Yeah, and that's interesting. This is why you, in your book, you argue Nietzsche's himself the critical historian, because modern science is sort of on the decline with its obsession with antiquarian history. So Nietzsche has the, I mean, it's interesting. I like the way you read it as a kind of life, you know, mapping on the sort of life cycle of a nation. You want to say more about Nietzsche as a critical historian?
Well, sure. I mean, my reading of those are the first three sections of the essay, and then in the remainder of the piece, I say what Nietzsche is doing is that he exits section three, which concludes with an account of critical history and a call for something new, the development of a new nature. He exits that section. And then in the remaining sections, he conducts a critical history of German culture, which he sort of had begun doing also in David Strauss, The Professor and the Writer, of course. And so you get claims throughout sections 4 through 9, Nietzsche will list off 5 or 6 things that are wrong with contemporary German culture, German historicism. He goes through very meticulously and shows what some of the things we've already talked about, what scientific history does to the soul, what Hegel has done to us. He'll say things like, you know, at one point, he calls, I think this is in section 8, he calls the Germans antiquarians twice in the same little paragraph. And so he really, and then he goes through and he says, well, here's the kinds of illnesses that Hegelian historicism causes, and here's the kind of illness that scientific history causes. And if you go back and you read antiquarian history, his account of antiquarian history in decline, it maps on to those diagnoses of the problems with German culture and their obsession with historical scientific preservation. And so by my reading, Nietzsche is a critical historian of his own culture, which is exceedingly antiquarian and is paving the way for the creation of a new culture, a sort of refounding, as he said, all critical historians do, by way of pointing in the direction of new monumental human beings. There are places in the sections 4 through 9 where he'll say to the Germans, nourish your souls on Plutarch. He returns to monumental history and says, instead of studying scientific history, read some of these monumental historians. And so my claim is that he paves the way for a new kind of monumental type to arise. He hopes such a type will arise. And so he points in the direction of the sequels, Schopenhauer's Educator and Richard Wagner in Bayreuth, both of which are fictionalized sort of monumental accounts of people, and in Ecce Homo, he says they were actually about me. And so it seems to me that he's got the book as a whole, The Untimely Meditations, has a similar structure to the monumental antiquarian critical trilogy and life cycle.
Yeah, that's really good. I agree that he's engaging in a kind of critical history. The only thing I'd add to that is that I think it's not simply critical history, as he's also, I think, engaged in trying to attain the perspective of the supra-historical perspective. This is something we haven't yet talked about, but in the first section of the book, he distinguishes between ahistorical, historical, and supra-historical perspectives. There's the very famous opening section of the Use and Disadvantage, where he says, you know, behold, and he uses the betrachten, the word from Untimely Meditation, unzeitgemäße Betrachtungen, and he says, behold the herd. He imagines looking at animals, and he says, we have a kind of envy of them because they're ahistorical. They stand outside of the historical chain of events. We are historical beings. We're weighed down by our history, right? And so much of the work is an attempt to give a kind of philosophical analysis of the structure from pre-modernity into modernity of what that historical perspective is like, or how human beings have carved it up and made sense of it, given a source of fulfillment, turned it from something that is deeply dissatisfying, right? Bearing the weight of history can be deeply troubling, especially in a Schopenhauerian universe. And so human beings have devised these various ways to bring a kind of satisfaction to history, the three types that we mentioned, and then modern scientific view of history, if it sort of fails to give a satisfaction. But then he also, in the first section, mentions the third perspective on history that we can take, distinctive to the human, also distinctive to human beings, which is a supra-historical perspective, where we can ascend above the historical chain of events that we do in the, mm-hmm. the historical perspective and see ourselves as just a link in the chain. But rather than the supra-historical perspective, we take a kind of God's eye perspective where we can ascend above the chain. We can take a reflective distance above that. I think this is the important, you know, moment of freedom that Nietzsche sees, that human beings can do this out of our freedom, that we can reflectively abstract ourselves away from any perspective that we find ourselves in. In any case, what we can do in the supra-historical perspective is to find enduring types, what he calls, and assume a kind of wisdom, what he calls wisdom as opposed to knowledge, that wisdom gives us the understanding of the enduring types in history. And I think that that's absolutely crucial for thinking about this essay and then the sort of positive project in Schopenhauer's Educator to think about the enduring types that we find. He's looking for enduring types of history and then enduring types of individuals that we can retrieve. So it's a critical perspective, but one that sort of helps us raise to the level of the supra historical.
Right. Yeah. Right.
You could say, if you want to say something about that, you can. I wanted to ask another question. Well,
I think only thing I would say about that is that I was puzzled by that part. You make good sense of it. And the reason I was puzzled by it, and I've benefited from your interpretation, is that, you know, he says that when he finishes describing the super historical person, that we'll leave them their exhaustion and their wisdom, and then we'll move on.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, does that mean that he's in a way disavow? And now you read it as, no, he's in fact not disavowing that view. And I thought, is he saying, well, you know, that's not us, and now let's move on. And so, you know, it's just, it was hard for me to make sense of that message.
Yes. Right. I mean, he sees the Schopenhauerian type. This is what Schopenhauer is, of course, famous for. I mean, he assumes a super historical perspective. Schopenhauer is a famous sort of ahistorical thinker in that sense. And this makes him quite different than Hegel, his great enemy, that he's looking for enduring types. So in some ways, Nietzsche is developing his super historical perspective from Schopenhauer. The lesson that Schopenhauer draws from the super historical perspective is, oh, dear Lord, how terrible the world is. And so I at least see that, you know, let's leave the historical perspective to the, you know, sort of exhausted types. It's really, you know, like, let's leave that approach to super historical behind and try to retrieve a new mm-hmm. form of it. Now there are some scholars who say, you know, it's just sort of, Nietzsche just abandons the super historical perspective. And indeed, it's not repeated in his corpus. He talks about, you know, the historical consciousness a little bit later in his corpus, which is a kind of analog of the historical perspective that he's talking about in Use of Disadvantage. But Nietzsche is emphatic that throughout his career about trying to find enduring types. This is something that's sort of types of individuals, types of cultures. So he sort of maintains that effort. I think the other big, puzzle in about Use and Disadvantage, it's not a puzzle. So it's a different, it's a reading, and I'll see what you think about it, because I have, of course, since you read the book, a clear view on this, which is the Use and Disadvantage of History for Life is read as sort of exhibit A in Nietzsche's early period mythic thinking, you know, like pro-mythic thinking, that in Birth of Tragedy and in The Untimely Meditation, so the lesson goes, Nietzsche endorses a perspective where a kind of anti-Enlightenment mm-hmm. perspective, where he, you know, disavows this endless accumulation for knowledge and asks human beings to return, you know, it's like a turtle going back into a shell, I imagine, you know, just like hunch yourself back into those closed horizons of those mythic horizons. And that's the way to find a kind of satisfaction. Mm-hmm. This is the, you know, in the first section of the Use and Disadvantage of Life, he talks about the ways in which cultures have a kind of balance between historical consciousness and an ahistorical mm-hmm. consciousness. And that's how we can sort of address the problem. And so readers have read this as as a sort of endorsement of Nietzsche's view that in order for human society to go forward, we need to take the lesson of life and close our blinders in a certain way and embrace certain kind of myths, even willfully. And some scholars bite the bullet on this. Bernard Yak, who I love, he's one of, he's influenced me deeply about Nietzsche, but you know, he says this explicitly in his book that even if we recognize, even if we know that this myth isn't true, we still have to accept it as true. And I found that a kind of deeply unintelligible view. But fortunately, I think it's not, I don't think it's Nietzsche's view. I think that Nietzsche is giving an account in that first section of the ways in which pre-modern cultures have answered the problem that history gives us, that life gives us. And if the pre-modern cultures have always closed their horizons and declared they, those people over there are barbarians and we are the true chosen people or whatever. But Nietzsche emphatically, even in the first section, talks about the way in which that perspective, the closed perspective, the mythic perspective is deeply unjust. And that he gives this analogy with a man in love, which you'll recall, right? The man in love, it's just like the person with the culture with the closed blinders. The man in love just loves his beloved and misses all her faults. And he loves her infinitely more than she deserves to be loved, he says, which is, I think, a deeply telling line from Nietzsche saying, we close our horizons, but we shouldn't do that. This is, and so I think that really challenges the deep level, the view that Nietzsche is a mythic thinker that he then overcomes in the middle period and becomes an Enlightenment thinker. It's much more complicated than that. Nietzsche is critical of that mythic view. What did you think about that reading?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, well, just on the basis of my own views, I'll say this. I tend in the direction of the mythic reading, but I am intensely aware of its problems. And I think so. The reason that I tended in the direction of the mythic reading of Nietzsche, sort of the return to myth, in this book in particular, just to take it separate from everything else, is that in the Wagner piece, which we'll talk about briefly later, Nietzsche venerates Wagner for being a new myth creator in modern times. Mm-hmm. And there's even a wonderful line where he says history becomes myth in his hands. Wagner takes history in a way that shows Wagner is a monumental historian. Wagner takes history and he creates myths from it that inspire, and they're fictionalized, but they're sort of based on history. So they're sort of monumental history. So insofar as Nietzsche points to Wagner as a kind of solution to the problem, I'd read the book as him pointing to myth as a solution. Now, let me say that I think I'm of two minds on this. I think in his late writings, Nietzsche is deeply dissatisfied, and I think, as most people agree, turns on that view. I am also deeply dissatisfied with that view in The Use and Disadvantage of History. Whether or not Nietzsche is skeptical of it, I can't say, but I do think that perhaps by the time he got to Richard Wagner and Bayreuth, even as he was writing those words, which were in some cases painful to him, I think, to write because he didn't like Wagner all that much, I think he may not, if he is endorsing a kind of thoroughgoing mythic return, he's aware of its problematic character. And I think for Nietzsche, in my reading of Nietzsche's corpus as a whole, this becomes the question for Nietzsche, is how can you believe something which you know is not true? How do we get that project off the ground? On the other hand, I see people will say, I mean, you mentioned this sort of in a way that how could you even begin to do this? How can, in the period of Enlightenment, the age of scientific history, how could we have a return? I see in my own time people believing all sorts of things and willfully, you know, closing themselves off and sort of willingly living in ahistorical perspectives. We see this in our own political rhetoric. Sometimes we talk about the denial of facts and, you know, wanting to believe something that's true is not true. And in a certain sense, this is not unsymptomatic of the ahistorical closed horizon. And so sometimes I think to myself, well, maybe closed horizons, maybe they're impossible for academics or something like that, but maybe for, you know, large groups of people, it's not so unlikely, it's not so improbable, and it's life promoting. And so maybe it's not as impossible as we once, or as we like to say. But on the other hand, I see for Nietzsche as a man who is very thoroughly aware of this, of the problems of return that you rightly mention, your solution would make some sense because it gives an account of his awareness and thus gives him more credit than maybe the pure mythical return position does.
Yeah.
And but I think it's a problem for him.
Yeah. I mean, I think the connection with, you know, contemporary fake news and et cetera is useful here because, I mean, so let's set aside the problem of whether it's possible or not to assume a mythic perspective in modernity. Because, okay, so that might be an open question in Nietzsche. I think, though, if you think about the desirability of it, I think there's also reason to be skeptical that Nietzsche thinks it's good for human beings to return to a closed horizon. Now, why is that? Well, so in The Use and Disadvantage of History for Life, a section we haven't talked about yet, which is section 6, Nietzsche talks about justice and the just man. And it's this remarkable section that scholars really haven't talked about, but the just man is the man who can ascend above horizons, give the law to humanity as a whole. And this is something that's only possible when you ascend above myth, right? And so one of the distinctive things about modernity for Nietzsche, and one of the things that's good about it in his view, right? He's not simply he's not a pre-modern thinker in that sense. He's not sort of reduplication of a Plato or an Aristotle or in some readings. He's a modern in the sense that modernity has given us a universal perspective on the whole, right? I mean, this is the thing that modern science has done. It's exploded all horizons. Whether we can, you know, willfully or not, return to pre-modernity, that's one thing. But for Nietzsche, we shouldn't. Because the explosion of horizons gives us the possibility of developing exemplars who are truly universal, mm-hmm. right? And so the Schopenhauer's educator, I think when he goes on to talk about the exemplars there, Rousseau, Goethe, and Schopenhauer, one of the things that makes them different than, say, a Alexander or, you know, whoever from Plutarch, is that they have a universal perspective on humanity. They're not Athenians or Romans, right? And so this is something that in my view, this sort of exemplary freedom of these great individuals who have the good of humanity in mind is sort of the way to redeem modern life, mm-hmm. that opens us up to the perspective of, so in other words, I'll quit here, but the idea is not, oh my gosh, modernity has opened up floodgates, let's close them down. Modernity has opened up the floodgates and we need to know how to deal with what to do about it. And it's these exemplary individuals who can redeem that the problems of the sort of universal perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Well, good.
Yeah, I mean, sure.
Maybe I have a convert in you, Shiloh.
No, what you say, I mean, it makes some sense. But anyways,
let's talk about Schopenhauer's, because I'm looking at the clock and we're certainly not going to have even time for Richard Wagner. But maybe let's talk about Schopenhauer's educator for a little while. Maybe to be like more structured about it. I thought what I could do is see what you thought about the what seems to me to be a problem with the work, which is raised a lot of scholarly disagreement, which is in that. So in the first section of Schopenhauer's Educator, Nietzsche has this very famous section, which really I often cite to challenge the kind of elitist radical aristocratic view of Nietzsche, which is Nietzsche has this very egalitarian view. He says every human being is a unique miracle and each of us should live up to their own calling and climb up the ladder to our own true selves and so forth. And then, but then in section 6, he has one of the most elitist claims in his entire corpus that, you know, human beings only gain value in virtue of being a contribution to the life of the exemplary individual. I don't know if you want to sort of speak to that puzzle, how both of those claims can be true, or anything else that you want to bring up about what's significant about Schopenhauer's educator.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding, that's a hard that's a hard nut to crack. And maybe the way I crack it won't be satisfying, although I point the finger back at you and say you do the same thing at one place in your book. But anyway,
guilty.
I think that the book, you know, the book, the Untimely Meditations are directed at the young. And Nietzsche is a master rhetorician. He had studied, obviously, Aristotle's rhetoric, and his late works are appealing to young people more than any other philosopher. He knows what to say to the heart. And oftentimes, Nietzsche will say, especially in the late works, he's just a master of manipulation, and he'll say something to the heart. And I find this in myself when I was much younger, and certainly my students now, and they just passionately and fervently believe it. And then he walks away from that slowly. And oftentimes, if you're not reading really carefully, you don't even see it happening. I think Schopenhauer's Educator is above all an essay about a great educator. That's what the first part says. Here is what your educators do for you. And I think by the time you get to this point in the book, especially if you've just read The Use and Disadvantage of History as a young person in the German education system, let's say, you're saying, this guy is speaking my language. This guy, I mean, I'm on board with this guy, you know, 100%, the passion with which he speaks. And so I read that first part of Schopenhauer differently than you do, insofar as I think, in a way, Nietzsche's flattering his reader there. And this may betray that I lean more toward the elite side of Nietzsche, but I think he's saying, he's not going to come out at the beginning and say, you need to study with the philosopher, or you need to devote your life to the production of great human beings because you're worthless. That's not a great way to, and I don't think he thinks worthless, you know, I'm just being extreme here, but that's not a great way to seduce a person to your project. So I think he begins the essay by saying, you, in a way, to the young people, you're a genius. Look how unique you are. Look how, modern education, for better or for worse, especially in the preschools, I have a daughter at a daycare center. They do this to the young, you know, they tell the young people these things. And we know, as people who have, you know, been hardened by the injustices of the world, that, you know, that's just not true. And so I think that Nietzsche's, that part of the book is in a way seductive, and that by the time section six rolls around, Nietzsche takes the gloves off. And he does. I mean, there are points where he says, look at the non-philosopher compared to the philosopher, the flickering reason, look at you yourself compared to Schopenhauer. You see that you are not the type of human being toward whom nature pointed. You know, he says some pretty, you know, disturbing thing to somebody who's really taking it seriously. But I think at that point, you have to, you know, the reader, if they're still on board with Nietzsche, they have to harden up and say, I'm not Schopenhauer, I'm not Wagner, and I'm not Nietzsche either. But I, you know, I see the value of this project. So that's how I solve that problem. Whereas I think you take that first part, which I claim is rhetorical, and then you put a lot of stock and a lot of weight in that for your interpretation, your meritocratic interpretation of Nietzsche, which seems to say, you know, that this kind of greatness is not fully available to everyone, but everyone can be uplifted, which I don't necessarily disagree with, by the way. But then there's another part in the essay, I can't remember, where you do play the rhetorical card. And I can't remember, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, good. Yeah, I actually don't remember either. But yeah, I know. We play these cards when it's convenient for us, right? It's hard to get the covering interpretation. So that's my story. I mean, I won't go into detail on my approach to it, but just to say this, that, you know, if you develop a Kantian reading of Nietzsche, as I do, I think one of the things that follows from it is a rejection of what I take to be a pretty standard way of reading Nietzsche, which is that there are some individuals who are graced by nature to be awesome. Mm-hmm. And then some who are terrible, and we should just enslave the latter for the former, right? Yeah. I mean, you know this. Like, this is a pretty standard reading, and I think that that's deeply wrong for a couple reasons. I mean, one, if you think about the Kantian approach to it, that this is a project about freedom, that nature doesn't really care about us. Nature does not then give us any license to declare one person as good, as better than another. Or indeed, if it does sort of grace someone with more capacities than another, that doesn't in itself support some kind of claim of excellence. We have to do something with those capacities in order to grant ourselves some excellence. That it's only through our free effort, and that's why I have this, as you mentioned, a kind of meritocratic rather than an aristocratic reading of Nietzsche, that first section of Schopenhauer's Educator points in the direction to the fact that all individuals it's within the capacity of all individuals to be great individuals. Now, having said that, Nietzsche then proceeds in the rest of Schopenhauer's Educator to talk about all the tremendous numbers of obstacles that the modern age places in the way of becoming an exemplary individual, right? The seductions of state power, the seductions of modern commercial life, the seductions of the social status. And so it turns out that these forces are so powerful that we need to devote most of our efforts to clearing them away, right? And sort of make the way for the exemplar. Mm-hmm. And you know, the last point I'd say about this is certainly about the sort of crude, you know, natural inequality reading in Nietzsche, is that Nietzsche is clear, I think, in those important sections 5 to 6 about how individuals benefit from devoting themselves to the production of culture and to the production of exemplary individuals, right? That they, in a sense, that the exemplars, in a sense, realize their own true selves, that individuals sort of participate in the achievement of excellence through that kind of effort of cultural construction. And so Nietzsche talks about this as a sort of voluntary process on the part of individuals, that you have to consecrate yourself to culture, right? It's not that, you know, the great people are coming around and rounding you up and consecrating you for you. It's emphatically not that. This is, as you said near the beginning, a project of education that, you know, to sort of encourage people to see this effort as something that's good. And it's not, you know, it wouldn't be that effective to just talk about how awesome Schopenhauer and Wagner is. You have to also have to talk about how this is a project for each person's realization.
Sure. I agree with you on that point. And I struggle with this, and your interpretation sort of helped me see some things about this. I mean, I was just rereading over parts of my book and I saw myself struggling with this. And you're absolutely right that Nietzsche says that this project of surrounding human beings, or of having an exemplar around whom we rally, that benefits everybody. I think that's clear. And so I think that the reason, or the account of Nietzsche as a kind of person where, you know, we're all slaves on the backs of whom great men arise, at least in the early works in Schopenhauer's Educator, that's false. But one thing that I come back to, because I guess I do tend in a way in the elitist direction on Nietzsche, is that I don't deny that ordinary average cultural people would benefit from the project. But I think Nietzsche is clear that the goal is, and he uses the word, the goal is the production of great human beings. A very fortunate byproduct is that we're all going to be uplifted as a consequence. And so in a way, I'm trying to have it both ways and split the difference. And I think...
I think that that's fair enough. I mean, I think, when I and you use these terms like elitist interpretation, I mean, in a way, that's not a helpful term, because I would describe my own view as elitist too, in a certain way. Like, if you mean by that pro elite, then you know that's my view too. If you know, and sometimes people use the term aristocratic, which is closer, because that's the term that Nietzsche himself will use. And I would say yes, that my view is aristocratic too, because Nietzsche thinks that, well, we're interested in producing the aristoi, right? And he's anti-democratic in its effort to decline the lowering of standards. I think where I depart from some readings, and I'm not sure about yours, but where I depart from some readings is the way in which some readings talk about the source of greatness, or the source of goodness in nature as opposed to in freedom. And then in the, I think, consequences, or what that license is politically, that some readings will talk about how that license is all sorts of redistributive efforts towards, you know, Tom Herka talks about this interest, the Maximax view. We should maximize the goodness of the best off, as opposed to the least well off is enrolled. Yeah. And I think that that's just wrong. I mean, Nietzsche does not think that licenses those kinds of efforts.
That's right.
Maybe you want to close to talk about Nietzsche's politics at all. Is there anything that you want to, because I mean, I have also a controversial view about Nietzsche's liberal leanings, but maybe I don't know if you want to talk in about any of your views about Nietzsche's politics.
Well, I mean, my view, in a way I can dodge the question by saying I think Nietzsche is a cultural thinker, not a political one.
Yeah. I agree, actually. So then we're similar on that. Go ahead. Yeah.
But someone's like going to, you know, pin me down on it, I do tend in the direction of Nietzsche as being, you use the more accurate word, an aristocratic thinker, more than a person who's thought, enriches democracy through notions of contest or these sorts of things. And so I think, I don't wholly subscribe to sort of there's this book, Nietzsche and the Aristocratic Radicalism, the Politics of Aristocratic Radicalism, book and these sorts of things. I don't wholly subscribe to sort of that school of thinking. And some of the listeners may not be familiar with the literature. So this simply means that what was said a moment ago, that Nietzsche really does think that maximizing, the support for the best is the way to go in politics. In Schopenhauer's Educator, he very clearly says, at one point the philosopher says, take care of, he says, the job of the philosopher, or the philosopher would say to you young people, take care of me because I have another more important job, namely taking care of you. I don't know if you remember that quotation, but some indication that at least the early Nietzsche wasn't so hardly aristocratic. But in general, I think on the whole, I do tend to think that, especially in Beyond Good and Evil, the production of the great human type returns. In Beyond Good and Evil, certainly Nietzsche's less moderate about the methods of that production. I think on occasion, there are places in Beyond Good and Evil where he references the creation. It even happened some in Schopenhauer's Educator, of a brotherhood of philosophers who would govern indirectly, because contact with the people is sullies and dirties a human being, but that they could sort of govern indirectly as a brotherhood and these sorts of things. And Nietzsche does talk about the need, as certainly in other books, late books, that there will be extraordinary human suffering. Michael Gillespie talks about this a lot in his most recent book, extraordinary human suffering, to bring about the vision of the human being that Nietzsche has in mind. Those things just aren't, to me, simply friendly to liberalism. And so I tend to read Nietzsche, certainly the late Nietzsche's politics, as being somewhat more radical in the aristocratic sense. And for that reason, troubling on occasion.
Yeah. We just had, I don't know if you listened to the last podcast on Ronald Biener, but we had a lengthy conversation. He cited a lot of these same passages to me about them. The wars right. of spirit, and it's gonna, yeah. And I mean, my general response to that was, and continues to be, that it's not clear to me that Nietzsche is actually celebrating those developments. No. That these may be sort of his prediction of what's going to happen as a result of the logical tendencies of democratic modernity. So Beyond Good and Evil, he'll talk about the democratizing conditions of modernity and how it makes it ripe for the development of tyrants of all forms, including the most spiritual, right? And so one way to read that is, he's calling for Hitler or something, but that seems wrong to me. I mean, when he talks about the most spiritual form of the will to power, he's talking about the development of a kind of spiritual power in the form of artists, religious saints, or philosophers, who are sort of providing a way for people to move forward. And aristocratic, I myself think, Nietzsche is an aristocrat as well. Of course, you can be a liberal and be an aristocrat at the same time. If you want to distinguish the cultural, the political elements, for instance, Jakob Burckhardt, one of Nietzsche's teachers, was, in the words of one scholar, an aristocratic liberal. That's how he's often described. Schopenhauer has a liberal view of the role of the state. It just returned to one of your points that you made earlier, which is that Nietzsche's project originates in a project of political skepticism, right? That he's deeply skeptical of the powers of the modern state and how often those forces can be used for the corruption of spiritual aims. And so at the end of the 10th section of of Schopenhauer's Educator, where he talks about the relationship between the state and the individual, he talks about Plato and Plato's Republic, and often Nietzsche's politics is portrayed as a kind of an analogy with Plato's Republic. But in the 10th section of the Schopenhauer's Educator, he talks about how Plato's Republic, that model has been corrupted and misused throughout history, which makes me think, you know, why would Nietzsche himself want to sort of reduplicate that same thing? If, again, you know, we see almost immediately after he dies, you know, his philosophy put to nefarious ends. So, yeah, I mean, Nietzsche also, as I mentioned in the last podcast, talks about the sort of tension between the philosophical life and the practical life. And these are all issues I think we could take up if we had, you know, another hour and a half to talk about. But do you want to say, we close anything more about the significance of the Untimely Meditations for Nietzsche's later work? What kind of, you know, what the ways in which Nietzsche changes his views, or ways in which the Untimely Meditations sort of sheds light on later stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably a lot of ink has been spilled on the way Nietzsche changes his views, and so maybe I won't say as much about that. I think, you know, people often say, well, the early period did. I mean, this would push back against some of the things we've said, but the early period is sort of this mythical period, and then he has this middle period where there's this enlightenment, and then where he sort of moves away from art as a kind of redeemer and moves towards science as a redeemer. And then in some senses, some people will say, and he continues that through the late period, and then, you know, and other people will say, and I tend more toward this, that the late period is sort of a fusion of the early and the middle in a certain sense, a moderation of both. But with respect to what the Untimely Meditations in particular can offer people primarily interested in books like Thus Spoke Zarathustra or Beyond Good and Evil, I would say that what I try to argue is that the Untimely Meditations is a prototype for the project, a blueprint for the project that Nietzsche would continuously refine and return to throughout his career. And that project, by the project, I mean the advancement of the human species for the sake of the love of mankind. You see this in Zarathustra, you see this in Beyond Good and Evil, a kind of fear of our decline, a spiritual decline, and then a hope that there can be some sort of massive lightning strike. That is the structure of the Untimely Meditations. It begins with a fear. And so in a way, I draw in my book a line from the Untimely Meditations to Thus Spoke Zarathustra. Thus Spoke Zarathustra begins with the terrifying specter of the emergence of the last man and a promise that a type of human being can arise called the Superman or the Overman, who is in a way the solution to that problem. And, you know, and the solution is, in a way, it comes through the creation of a new kind of culture, the tablets of values and these sorts of things. I think that that structure is present fundamentally in the Untimely Meditations, with the cultivated Philistine being analogous to the last man and the redeeming human being analogous to Nietzsche's hopes that a higher human type could arise and take humanity by the reins and, you know, ride them to new heights. So I think for people who... And by the way, in some of Nietzsche's letters, you quoted some of these too, but he'll tell some of his friends and some later writers on him, you should compare Schopenhauer's Educator to Thus Spoke Zarathustra. And this is also why he says in Ecce Homo, these books are about me. Schopenhauer and Wagner, or in one word, Nietzsche. He says Schopenhauer, as Educator, contains my conception of the philosopher. So anyone interested in the new philosopher, this is the post Beyond Good and Evil Nietzsche saying, if you want to know what a philosopher is, you go to Schopenhauer as Educator. And so I think that the blueprint for Nietzsche's project, as it were, as it's articulated later, is contained in a nascent and early sense in the Untimely Meditations. And after this book, he spent the rest of his career, and if you don't want to say the rest, well, certainly from Zarathustra forward, refining, tweaking, making more clear, and certainly changing, I don't deny that at all, but the same instruments, the same fundamental mechanism, the same problem, and its solution through human types and culture, and the you know, in Beyond Good and Evil, the philosopher is said to be the new philosopher, a Caesarian cultivator, cultural man of power. It's all there. It's all in the Untimely Meditations. And so they seem to me to be, in a way, I argue, Nietzsche's own autobiography, the story of himself, how he became who he was. He says this in that Schopenhauer's Educator contains my history. Richard Wagner and Weyruth contains a vision of my future. And also his project seems to me to be contained in these four essays.
Yeah, well, Shiloh, this has been a lot of fun, but I mean, I guess I have to apologize to readers or listeners for doing so much on Nietzsche, but Nietzsche is endlessly interesting. So I thank you for spending some more time with Nietzsche with me.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.